With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public, free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom, and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Time for another Legal Hub program. Nick Kearney, lawyer Nick Kearney, joins me to chew over some of the legal cases and issues of, well, sort of the last week. Nick, good to have you back.
Yeah, good to be back, Paul. Good morning, and good morning to all of your listeners.
All right, I want to talk about what lawyers should say to other lawyers, or maybe not say, and what does the Standards Committee of the profession make of all that. We'll look at that shortly. But first of all, people will be across, or some of our listeners will be across the news in the last few days of the fines that have handed down to those involved in the Bacardi White Island tragedy. It was a tragedy. What? Over 20 people died. I think over 20 people very badly injured. So what do we make of this? There's some big fines in there. Companies, some of them anyway, are not going to survive. Will those who, you know, were injured or survived, or families of those who died, get anything in the end? What do we make of this?
Well, to answer your second question first, I suppose, we have as people will be well aware, we have an ACC system in this country, which means you can't sue people in this country for personal injury suffered out of some negligent event. So in terms of, you know, victims directly, the ones who survived, that is directly receiving some compensation from a lawsuit from the helicopter companies or the other operators of this of the tourist facility will know that they won't receive a bean, right. Simply because of ACC. And there is a legal action, I believe, taken by an American family against one of the American victims who passed away. And I'd stop there for a second. There is actually an avenue to claim losses arising out of emotional trauma outside of the ACC regime, but it's very hard to prove. And there's also the ability to potentially claim under medical misadventure and things like that. But that a medical misadventure won't be part of any of this. So very difficult for victims here in New Zealand to have any direct compensation payment arising out of the events of the eruption of White Island and the death of people and injuries of family members and what have you. I do remember there was, and I haven't followed the story, but there was an American company, I think, or American family that was suing for such losses and injury. But
was it the cruise line?
It could be the cruise line, correct. That's right, yeah. And because the cruise line was not a New Zealand-owned business, I think it was offshore American-owned or something, they had a different, or claiming were a different jurisdiction applied. And so they could sue that cruise line in America for, you know, like America doesn't do things in halves when it comes to lawsuits for personal injury, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. But but in New Zealand, we've essentially got these WorkSafe prosecutions, and the WorkSafe prosecutions were of numerous operators of the tourism businesses that took some of these victims to White Island by helicopter. And then the other major prosecution was against the management company. So White Island was owned by a family, had been owned by a family since 1930 or so. And that family owned White Island, which is, in a trust. They leased the whole of White Island to a management company that they owned as well. Now, that management company that held the lease, if that's the word, of White Island, was simply a shell company that had no assets. It was just set up to be an intermediary between the owners of White Island and, I guess, people who visited it to separate out liability, and particularly for instances like this. And so this management company was the one that was found liable for various breaches of the Health and Safety at Work Act and the like. The management company was fined $1.04 million, and it was to pay reparations, ordered to pay reparations of $4.88 million. But the management company put its hand up in the court and said, sorry, we've got no assets. We're just a shell company that just exists on a bit of paperwork with the owners of the island, and we can't pay that. And the judge made a comment, well, that might be true, but perhaps the owners the owners of the company, which is the essentially the owner of the White Island, and what did he say here, the judge, reading from the judgment, there's nothing stopping the Buttles as the shareholders of the company from advancing the necessary funds to cover its reparation or fine obligations, the judge said. While there might be no commercial basis for doing so and legal basis that I can impose upon them for doing so, many would argue there is an inescapable moral one for doing so. Well, we'll see where that goes. But look, the short answer to this is that if the management company just wants to file for liquidation and insolvency, it can. It can say we've got a liability here of $4.9 million. We can't pay it. We'll just file for liquidation. The shareholders of that company aren't personally liable. And so, you know, that money will potentially never be paid.
Yeah, these fines, okay, $1.04 million you just talked about. I think White Island fined, limited fined, $517,000. Volcanic Air Safaris, $506,000. Arius fined, $290,000. I don't know who they are. And Kahu fined, $196,000. That money, where does it go? If they can pay these fines, who gets the money?
Oh, WorkSafe, the Crown.
Okay, so this is the...
Well, a fine is different from reparation. So yeah, we'll go back to the management company.
So these people are making money for the Crown.
Yeah. So this is my point. So WML, which is the management company, was fined $1.04 million, which was two charges of $522,500 each on each charge. That fine is essentially to the state. Okay. Then it was ordered to pay reparations to the victims of $4.88 million. So that was actually direct reparation. Reparation is ordered in a whole variety of criminal matters before the courts.
Would that be the emotional harm component then?
Yeah, potentially, yeah. It'd be part of it, yeah. So, you know, I mean, 47 victims potentially here, or 45 or whatever. So, 22 people died, I think it was, and 27 or 25 other victims that survived but were seriously injured.
Yep.
So you could, I don't know what the exact makeup of that $4.88 million was in reparations to be paid to these people, divided by 27, perhaps, I don't know, but, or 47 or 45, whatever, I don't know. But point is that the company said there's not $4.88 million in the bank, not even $1 in the bank to pay it, so can't be paid. And there's literally nothing that can be done. As the judge exasperatingly said in the decision, there's no commercial or legal basis for me to ask for the shareholders to pay that money, but many would argue there is an inescapable moral duty for them to do so. Okay, so you're pretty much tugging at the heartstrings to allow the Buttles, who are, you know, in the rich list, as I understand it, to fork out. And the other companies you mentioned there, White Island Limited, Volcanic Air Safaris and others, most of them were helicopter operators, some from Whakatane, one from Rotorua, one from Tauranga, I think, or somewhere else. So they were helicopter, Rotorua, I think, as well. They were helicopter operators that helicoptered people out to, because not all of those tourists on that day or the victims on that day came from that cruise ship. Some of them came from helicopter rides. And so they were the helicopter operating companies. And some of them, a couple of them before the final decision of the court were in liquidation themselves anyway. They, you know, basically deemed to be insolvent for whatever reason or wound themselves up, I don't know. But, I mean, again, they were, you know, ordered. One of them, White Island Limited, actually had insurance cover to sufficient to pay $5 million. And so, which was, I guess, is a pleasing thing. And the judge ordered that reparations for that particular company should be $5 million. So they just simply tapped the insurance company on the shoulder and said, well, you can pay this. Thanks very much. And so, yeah, I guess, you know, it's a very – the law, the criminal law and the law in general has always struggled over many years with finding companies liable for under the criminal law for the actions perhaps of the individuals behind the company. So we have talked in New Zealand for many years, and overseas they have got – in some jurisdictions they've got what's called corporate manslaughter. We have looked at it in New Zealand to have a corporate manslaughter charge, which would mean that a company and all the directors can be charged with manslaughter in the criminal sphere for actions, you know, and for events that that took place here. But we've never enacted it. It's a very difficult thing to do. And the backstop scenario is to have a relatively inadequate regime like this, where really it's kind of just a token gesture and nothing really eventuates in terms of inverted commas justice.
So it must be have been established then here that those companies had some kind of knowledge that there was danger, that they hadn't informed their customers about at all or adequately. I mean, you take your chances when you go, you know, ashore on an active volcano.
Yep, there's no specific. I mean, the Health and Safety at Work Act has obligations on people who are conducting a. They're called PCBUs, people conducting a business unit, I think it is. And so, if you're conducting a business unit, it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, a business of transporting tourists to White Island on a helicopter. It might just be, you know, operating a law firm or accounting office or something. If you're operating a business unit and you've got more than 20, I think it's 20 employees, I think it might be the threshold, or 18 or something, 14 maybe, you've got to take all reasonable precautions to ensure that the people under your care and control all health and safety measures, et cetera. So a lot of businesses these days, you know, even small to medium ones, have to have health and safety protocols, and you don't want to trip over that wire that's coming across the floor there that's connecting up the USB to the computer or something, you know. Mm-hmm. That's why you tape that over, you know, yeah. I mean, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, health and safety is – it's much more important for some industries. Building industry, scaffolding, forklifts, very, very high, you know, obviously incidents, I guess, of harm, not mm-hmm. so much perhaps in commercial offices. But my point is that there's not different thresholds for each business that operates a PCBU. It's kind of all the same threshold, except for each industry in situations like this, the, you know, the judge or the court would say, well, what is reasonable for this business to have assessed in terms of its health and safety protocols, compared with, say, just a guy running a corner dairy or a law firm with 20 staff or something. And for this one, you would expect that, you know, that the helicopter operators would look at the status of White Island and say, oh, gee, it's blowing a fuse. And I do understand, and I recall at the time, actually, that they it was well known around Whakatane and Ahopi that a couple of days before this thing blew, that they were expecting it. You know, there'd been a couple of minor blows, and there was directives issued that be careful. This thing, there might just be an explosion, or it might just go off in the next few days. It's showing a heightened sense of activity, I think, is kind of what the wording was. And sure enough, it happened when there were 47 people on the island.
Okay. I was in news at the time. I remember the day it happened, and it was an incredible day. It was
there was an
unfolding tragedy.
Yeah, a documentary made on it too, which I watched on television maybe a couple of years ago, and some of the people that were shepherded back from the island to Whakatane, you know, and some of the heroics. I mean, there were police officers and others who went over there when really they risked their lives to go over there and try and rescue people off that island. Mm. And some of them, if you remember, were charged as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. for trying to be heroes, basically. But some of these boats, you know, that were shepherding people back to Whakatane or Rotorua or whatever, they only had capacity for sort of 8 people, but they sort of had 20 victims on it, you know, because they had no other boats over there. And because of that, the boats could only chug back at sort of 5 knots. Yeah. And so, you know, they couldn't get back there.
It's about 20 Ks off the coast.
About 20 Ks, you know, if they only had, you know, 8 or 10 people on the boat, you get back there in, you know, 40 minutes or something, or an hour, 45, whatever it was. But because they had, you know, twice and a half the number of people, it could only chug at sort of 5 knots. It took them 4 hours. And in the meantime, these people have got third-degree burns. It's absolutely horrific to even think about, to be honest, yeah.
All right. From that, we go to another local story, and the heading is, lawyers should maintain appropriate professional boundaries with colleagues at all times. A standards committee has determined that a senior lawyer's inappropriate comments made to a junior member of staff about physical appearance during a telephone conversation breached Rule 10. Oh, what's Rule 10?
I'll come to Rule 10 in a minute, but if you remember, some months ago we discussed on this program a decision of the Nelson branch of the Law Society, which ruled, I think, quite helpfully or quite pleasingly, I suppose, on a lawyer who had Sue Gray, and she had had a complaint made against her. I forget the exact nature of it was, but the Law Society dismissed the complaint and upheld that her freedom of expression was more important, and lawyers should have a very high have freedom of expression for things that they are advocating for, etc. So that was a very pleasing ruling. This is something slightly different and a bit weird, I suppose. Rule 10 of the professional standards is that a lawyer must promote and maintain professional standards. And they made a mention too of Rule 10.1. A lawyer must, when acting in a professional capacity, treat all persons with respect and courtesy. Okay, yep. So maintain professional standards, have respect and courtesy for other people.
Fair enough.
There's an argument here that, you know, potentially when acting in a professional capacity, you're acting in a capacity as a lawyer, acting for your clients.
Oh, so that's how you'd maintain a collegial relationship as well?
Well,
in more context.
Well, Rule 10 is a lawyer must promote and maintain professional standards. It doesn't say, you know, only when acting as a lawyer for your client and dealing with other lawyers or whatever else. It just says you must promote and maintain professional standards.
Even when you're asleep?
Well, when you're out maybe at a restaurant and, you know, you sort of say the F word or something and someone knows you're a lawyer and they complain or whatever. You know, so exactly, that's my point. And there's been, and then the next one is, you know, a lawyer must, and these are the key words, when acting in a professional capacity, treat all persons with respect and courtesy. Well, I remember done a bit of work for real estate agents in the judicial, who have faced judicial complaints and the like, and I paid particular attention to a case I wasn't involved in, but there was a real estate agent, and I may have mentioned this on the show before, actually, but there was a real estate agent who, in South Auckland somewhere, was out one night, and he was in a bar, and he was partaking in stuff you shouldn't partake in, you know, or maybe you should. It depends. Personal choice, I suppose. He wasn't harming anybody. I think he'd taken a bit of drugs, a bit drunk. And he was trying to, you know, introduce himself to a female person in the bar. End of the day, he gave his business card to her. Oh, if you ever need to sell a property or something, look me up. And she's, well, I wouldn't sell a property with you. You're halfwit or whatever. But anyway, that's kind of how it ended. Well, she made a complaint.
That's very judgy, very judgy.
It is. She made a complaint. Well, look, and that's where it should end. That is where it should end, right? In my view, she'd just say, well, I don't.
She was a competitor, though, wasn't she?
No, I don't think she was. No, she was just a member of the public. Member of the public. And in the end of the day, the next day or week after, she made a complaint to the real estate agents. Authority that, you know, he was acting in an inappropriate manner towards her and his behaviour was unbecoming of a real estate agent. Well, of course, really? under the Real Estate Agents Act, you're only allowed to be complained of and about if you are undertaking what's called real estate agency work.
Yeah.
And that is basically allowing people to undertake a transaction to sell real estate.
Not handing over the business card.
Well, not in a pub talking crap and handing over business cards and being a bit drunk and being a bit lewd. You're not undertaking real estate agency work then. But the real estate agent's authority found him, yes, you can't behave like that, and this is just appalling, and we're going to find against you. And I don't know on what basis they did, but they did. Now, and this is my concern with decisions like that, is the creep into society of people who are just human beings, you know, and they should be allowed to go out, have a good time, let their hair down, behave a bit like a bit of an idiot. I mean, the only people who should be judging the idiocy of their behaviour is themselves and the people they're around with at the time, not their professional body, who a week or 3 months later decides to poke their beaks in to say, you know, goodness, you didn't flush the toilet when you went to that bloody restroom. That's conduct unbecoming of a real estate agent.
Yeah. You know, well, you're eating meat.
But this is my point. The slow creep of this stuff can turn into an avalanche if we don't hit it on the head.
What about people, though, who are so, well, I don't know, you know, we weren't there, but kind of snowflakey, you know, can people handle can't people handle anything anymore? Really?
No, I think people are very much oversensitive, and I don't believe they can. I think society's gone that way over the last...
And how can they see someone potentially losing their job proportionate to their little offence taken?
Well, and so coming back to this case here before the Law Society, so what happened was a lawyer made a phone call, allegedly on a phone call to another lawyer, and it was sounded like it was a relatively senior male lawyer speaking with another female lawyer. I don't know if they were in the same firm or not. I don't know. The complaint was that he made some comments in the phone call that the female lawyer thought was inappropriate. Okay, she thought it was inappropriate. Now, the committee here investigating it was satisfied that a phone call took place and that some comments were made by the male lawyer to the female lawyer. He said in his defence, well, I can't remember the phone call being made, but if I did make the phone call, if I spoke to this woman on the phone, you know, I don't believe what I would have said was in any way inappropriate or,
remember the call.
Unprofessional. He accepted that from, you know, just quoting from the decision, from time to time, he made platonic complimentary comments about staff members' appearance, but he asserted these never crossed the line into sexualized or inappropriate remarks. He disputed any telephone call took place at all, or that he made the comments alleged. Now, the committee found that on balance, they didn't have any physical evidence, on balance, the phone call was probably made. They then found...
Why don't she have a record of the call, wouldn't she?
Or they should do. I mean, you know, particularly in our office, I know we can go back...
You got a log, right?
Your whole log, exactly. We know.
Okay,
exactly.
Well, that seems a bit weird, but all right.
Who was called and for how long, exactly. And they said, look, but basically we find that they were a bit troubled by the fact that over a phone conversation, this lawyer had made, you know, or made some comments of that nature, whether they were inappropriate or not. They said that, look, it considered it unlikely for there to be a reasonable instance where it would be appropriate for a senior practitioner to comment on a colleague's physical appearance during a telephone conversation and not person to person.
Really? How do they know that?
Well, I mean...
People compliment each other all the time.
Well, you know, I could ring up... another lawyer I know in another firm or even internally to my own firm and talk to them and say, hey, by the way, I didn't say this yesterday, but that flowery dress you look bloody great in that bloody dress you're wearing, that new suit you wore yesterday, you look great in that. Well, where'd you buy that from? You know, where'd you get that from? It's awesome. I should encourage you to wear it more often because you look really styly or something. Now,
maybe that's a little awkward. I don't know. It's so hard to know.
Well, but this is my point. This is my whole point. It's so hard to know that eventually in society where we are going, I fear, is that people will not simply do or say anything for fear of upsetting somebody. And we've seen it time and time and time again. And here the Committee of the Law Society, let me just repeat what they said here. So the committee, you know, in giving its decision, was satisfied that the investigation struck a balance which substantiated it was more likely than not the call took place, and more likely than not comments were made by the lawyer, and here's the key bit, that the colleague regarded as inappropriate. She regarded them in her subjective opinion as inappropriate.
If they're saying it's more likely than not that the call took place, there seems to be uncertainty or an element of uncertainty that the call actually took place.
Correct.
How can you be so sure? That's loosey-goosey already, isn't it?
Well, he denied the call ever took place. There was obviously no – that they haven't made a finding here that it did take place. They just believed her, believed the victim, and said, well, we probably – she wouldn't have – perhaps made a complaint and lied about
really?
A phone call taking place. Well,
how do you know that? I mean,
well, you don't. That's kind of true. You actually don't. But you know, as the Law Society, their rulings committees have quite strong powers to demand, you know, those complained of to provide evidence and to provide documents and to provide other bits.
Unless it's too awkward to go too far into it, and it's easier just to deal with it this way.
Yeah, I mean, they could have ordered, you know, this man or her to produce the log of the phone call to prove it taking place, but none of that's mentioned here. I think is a bit of a misnomer. It's a bit unfortunate.
Well, when the guy says he can't even remember making the call,
don't even know what I said. Can't remember making the call.
And I mean, I remember the calls I make, right?
Well, to be honest, Paul, I don't, because I probably make about...
But if you said, okay, jumped in there, sorry, but if you said something that might be controversial or a little diverging from your normal conversations, you remember that when you go, oh, yeah, okay, sorry, I remember doing that, yeah.
You would, and I think that's right. You would probably remember... Yeah, who you spoke to, what you
said.
And
then you think, damn, I wish I never said that.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of gulp and go, shit, that was, oh, shouldn't have said that. 100%.
Yeah.
So there was nothing of that nature here at all, which I guess goes to the point that perhaps he never said anything. Anyway, but the committee, and here's the most important part, in my view, from a rulings committee, from a standards committee on rulings, that's trying to set standards for the conduct of lawyers to behave going forward. They said they did not seek to go behind the assessment and make any finding of any specific language used, nor to ascribe any inappropriate intent to the lawyer. In other words, we're not going to make a finding on what was said, we're not going to publish it, and we're not saying that he had an intent to be inappropriate or to harm her. We just find that something happened that we weren't that happy about. Now, if you're trying to, as a professional body that regulates a professional body, trying to improve the behaviour of the people who work in your body, you need to say what the words were, what the context was, so that anybody in the future can go, yeah, well, I won't be saying that or doing that, whatever, because that's wrong, you know? But they didn't publish the word. They haven't gone anywhere near that far to saying what it was. So I just find the whole thing extremely wishy-washy and actually quite disappointing in a way.
Is this fallout from that case a few years ago, you know, with the young lawyers and at the Christmas party, I forget the law firm, you know, which kind of highlighted this power imbalance issue between senior lawyers and junior lawyers?
I think it was.
And this is an oversensitivity and a reaction to that.
Yeah, I'm not going to name the law firm, but I know who you're talking about. I think I know what firm it was, but because I'm not 100% sure, I won't.
It was one of the big ones.
It was one of the reasons, and they had an office in Wellington and Auckland, and this occurred in the office in Wellington, if I believe. Well, it goes back further than that, actually, Paul. It goes back to complaints made around about 2018, 17, 18, or thereabouts, I think, by young junior lawyers of their time they spent at Russell McVeagh as law clerks and junior lawyers, and how some of the senior partners and, you know, hit on them, and some of them had, well, you know, I can call it, it was a consensual sexual relationship with some of these older lawyers. But arising out of all that was this, the Me Too movement, if you remember the Me Too movement.
Yep.
And of course, because they were just junior female lawyers, 23, 22, and it was more senior male lawyers, there was a power imbalance, and therefore the junior lawyer could never have consented.
I think that was the one I was thinking of. And I think alcohol might have been involved.
Almost certainly was. But arising out of that, and again, in one of the very early shows that we put on, we talked about the Law Society's new framework for its rules about how lawyers are to behave, and changed the Lawyers and Conveyances Act, et cetera, et cetera. So that all arose out of that, actually, and an investigation into that, an independent working group that put recommendations forward, which went from, you know, trying to improve the conduct of lawyers in situations like that, to every lawyer must learn Te Ao Māori and follow tikanga and know the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. So that's where it went to, and we discussed that some months ago here on the show. But that was the genesis of it, round about, you know, sort of 2017, 16, 17, 18 or so.
Yeah.
And as a result, some of the rules that we operate under have changed. They now include, you know, we can't harass and sexually harass and, you know, bully people, and we must, you know, maintain professional standards and not talk inappropriately to people. But of course, as we've just found, you're not allowed to know what the inappropriate language is.
Yeah, not knowing is, it's another weird part of it. Okay.
Yeah.
Guy can't remember making the call. No one can say what was said. Okay.
But don't do it again.
Yeah. I feel like playing, what's that Jackson Brown song, Lawyers in Love? I feel like playing that right now.
Don't know. Maybe after the show finishes,
you can. Yeah, we'll give it a spin. It's a good song from the 80s. Cool. All right. Just in the time we've got left, a couple of quickies, more international stories. Lockdowns, colonialist.
Lockdowns were a colonialist construct.
Yeah. So according to who?
Well, interestingly, according to a coalition of African scientists.
Oh, God.
And they have accused the World Health Organization of, quote, classic Western imperialism through the back door. And we've discussed this before, too, with the sweeping new pandemic treaty that the WHO is trying to enforce on countries that, you know, New Zealand at the forefront, well, not so much at the forefront, but of course we know who's in charge in the WHO now, don't we, trying to get it all through.
Yeah.
A certain man who was given a knighthood here in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And I think you know, Winston Peters and Chris Luxon, new government here, have kind of put a bit of a halt on this and said, we think it's going too far. We're not sure what we're going to do. It's certainly
national interest test is what they want.
Oh, well, and certainly if you look at, yeah. I mean, this coalition of African scientists here, they have the same criticism of the World Health Organization, WHO pandemic treaty as everybody else. But they're going further and saying, I mean, they're actually called the Pan-African Epidemic and Pandemic Working Group. But they argue lockdowns were a class-based, unscientific instrument of colonialism, that the World Health Organization's new powers threaten sovereignty, not just the sovereignty of nations, but the sovereignty of, you know, tribes within those nations. They will cause these new powers significant harm to low-income nations, and we know Africa's got plenty of those low-income nations, and they're arguing for a severe pushback and for these things not to go ahead. So that's quite interesting. That's only come out, let's have a look at the date of this, 8th of March, so we're talking a couple of days ago.
Yeah, okay.
And, all right, you know, I mean, even mentioned in this article is the fact that six MPs in the British Parliament wrote to the Foreign Office demanding that it blocks any new powers that could see the World Health Organization dictate policy and other things from Switzerland or wherever they are. You know, I mean, the UK has just fought a massive battle to try and bring its sovereignty back by getting itself out of Brexit. And now they'll be looking at signing up to something like this. So anyway, the battle's on, and which I think is actually quite pleasing.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It seems that the African countries, the continent of Africa, seem to do better in terms of COVID than anywhere else in the world, in terms of deaths, excess deaths, all those things. They've got better stats. And, of course, ivermectin is in huge use there for other things. So,
yeah,
so something going on there. All right, and I seem to ask this question every week. What is wrong with Canada, man? But anyway, I see there's Supreme Court's, this is probably quite reassuring, Supreme Court's ruled over IP addresses. What's happened there?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court of Canada, so this is not just a lower level court here. This is the highest court in Canada. And what happened here was there was a fraud committed on a shop, some sort of online banking fraud or something in a liquor shop. And the police contacted the store's third-party payment processing company to ask for the IP addresses used for the fraudulent transactions. And the company voluntarily provided that, okay? So this is the FPOS company or whatever, voluntarily provided those IP addresses. Police then used these IP addresses to obtain basically a search warrant to find out who owned these IP addresses. And they compelled the offender, the person eventually charged, a man by the name of Mr. Bykovets, Bykovets, they compelled his ISP, his internet service provider, to disclose the subscriber information from that. In other words, number 183-472- blah, 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 who owns this? And the ISP said, oh, that's Mr. John Bykovet. Okay, that gave his name and his residential address. The police executed a search warrant on Mr. Bykovet's his address and his father's address as well, and they arrested him for these criminal offences as a result of the information they obtained.
So he did do it?
Yep, he did do it.
We got the guy, all right.
We got the guy. He said at the lower court in his trial and that the police request for the IP addresses from the payment processing company violated his right against unreasonable search and seizure under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms in Canada. Now, we have a very similar, very, very similar provision in New Zealand against protection by, protection against the police's unreasonable search and seizure. And our unreasonable search and seizure provisions in our Bill of Rights was pretty much based directly off the Canadian one. Anyway, this took place in Alberta. The Alberta Court of Appeal upheld the trial court's decision and said that Section 8 did not apply because an IP address alone does not provide any information about a person's lifestyle or core biographical information, and therefore Mr. Bykovets had no reasonable expectation of privacy in the IP address and was not unreasonable search and seizure. Well, the Supreme Court has overturned that on a 5-4 majority decision and held that, in fact, he did have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his IP address, and therefore the police violated Section 8 by obtaining his IP address without prior judicial authorization. And they're the key things there. So the interesting thing about obtaining those IP addresses is they went to the, FPOS or whatever third-party provider and said, and just asked them, the police have only got, the powers to compel somebody to provide something, usually under a search warrant, if they don't want to provide them voluntarily. That's the general position for things. There's a few exceptions and things like the Arms Act and what have you. But anyway, in New Zealand that is at least. But, they went to the service provider and just said, hey, look, we're investigating some fraud here. We think this has happened. Are you willingly going to help us? Would you hand over this information? Oh, yeah, we're doing a good deed. You're doing a good deed. We will help you, the police out here. Here we go. Gave it over. There was no allegation of coercion or anything like that. But interestingly, the Supreme Court said they should not have done that, and in fact, that information was not able to be handed over without prior judicial authorization, which basically means a search warrant. Okay, so a search warrant. Now, there's nothing to, I mean, you might get a bit excited and say, "Goodness, does that mean that all IP addresses are, you know, therefore protected from unreasonable search and seizure here in New Zealand?" Potentially, yes, because you know we model our Bill of Rights on the Canadian Charter Rights and Freedoms as well. So potentially this decision could have some quite interesting ramifications in New Zealand into how our search and seizures are done by police here in similar circumstances. But there was an expectation, or not an expectation, there was an exception listed here by the judges that said without prior judicial authorization, in other words, without a search warrant allowing it.
Yeah, well, that sounds reasonable to guy on the street, me. I do think there's an expectation that an IP address, which is the gateway to who you are really online, isn't it, ultimately, does have, is a kind of a very personal thing. So they could have gone to, what, a judge or a court and got a search warrant and got that information that way anyway, I'm assuming, if they put a bit more work into it.
Correct. They could have. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, as you know, I read some commentary on this during the week, and one of the commentators basically said that, look, IP addresses themselves don't say much, if anything. It's just a number, you know, and doesn't really identify anybody, but they can be revealing when combined with or potentially combined with other information. So, and I think that's where you're coming from there, exactly. So,
The metadata around it.
Basically. Yeah, the metadata around it, exactly. Now, I don't know too much about this area. I find it reasonably interesting. Police powers, unreasonable search and seizure and the like, just out of interest sake, but I don't have much professional experience in it, apart from when I was in the police and we did it a bit. But I just don't know how it works. For example, if you had a person sitting online, partaking in pedophilia online, or you know, trying to download or get into chat rooms, in Thailand or somewhere where boys and girls are being bloody abused. You know what I mean? And the only way these people can be identified is through their IP address, and then the police have the IP address. And I don't know how the investigation proceeds here in New Zealand, for example, how the police, go from having an IP address for that particular offender to finding out who they are and where they live. But here, you know, as I say, Supreme Court of Canada just a few days ago, that information cannot be handed over willingly, voluntarily.
Never dull in the law.
Never Not dull. Usually, no.
No.
Not usually, no.
That was a very interesting range of topics for this week. Thank you, Nick Kearney, for coming in again for another Legal Hub.
No worries, Paul. Good to be here again, and thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you again in a couple of weeks, perhaps, or maybe even next week. I think Katie might be away next week, so I might have to double up.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day in life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.